time to start our last but absolutely not least session. It's my privilege to introduce Thomas Poga. We all suspect that he's probably known extremely well to every single person in this room, but I'll go ahead and introduce him anyway. I printed out his Wikipedia entry, but it caused my printer to run out of paper, so I'm going to do the abridged version. Dr. Poga is currently the director of the Global Justice Program and the Leitner Professor of Philosophy and International Affairs at Yale University. As many of you know, he's been involved in both a philosophical and practical way for a number of years in a project that aims to make medicines available to the world's poor. The arguments of this project are summarized in a monograph entitled The Health Impact Fund, Making New Medicines Accessible for All. More recently, he initiated the Academic Stand Against Poverty Global Project, which aims to provide both a theoretical framework and a practical arena for making a stand against global poverty. It's also worth mentioning that apart from his well-known work on global justice, health, and human rights, he's also written extensively on other questions, most notably with his PhD advisor, John Rawls, and his compatriot, so to speak, Immanuel Kant. I will list briefly some of the books that he has written: Politics as Usual, What Lies Beneath the Pro-Poor Rhetoric, and The Health Impact Fund, and World Poverty and Human Rights. I could go on and on, but you're not here to listen to me. You're here to listen to him. Thank you very much for being here.
Hey. Good. Thanks very much. So I was a little bit afraid that this would be boring for those of you who know about the Health Impact Fund, so I'm trying to say some new things and try to embed it in a somewhat different way to hopefully make it a little more interesting. So I'm in the camp of those in philosophy who think that the point of moral philosophy is to promote in the world the values that are morally important, that this morality itself deems to be important, to kind of solve human problems, to overcome conflicts. So it's not really a truth-finding mission, and maybe that is a bit of explanatory background to the whole Health Impact Fund project. So this is supposed to be a philosopher trying to be practically intelligent, trying to make a difference in the world. So I'll start with a few remarks as to why I think this Health Impact Fund project is important, or that it could be important, and what diagnosis of the current world underlies it. So start with some quite familiar thoughts from social theory. We live in a world of competitive and adversarial systems, markets, business, finance, academia, media, and so on are all governed by competitive rules of one way or another, and we are told in intro economics classes that competitive systems are very good, very powerful systems. They elicit the best efforts from people. They elicit truthful revelation of what people's capacities are. They're good at allocating people over the different roles and positions in a society. In short, competitive systems are very powerful ways of achieving socially valuable results. Whether we want education or justice or healthcare, competitive systems get us there, at least in the models of the economists. Now, proper framing of these competitive systems requires two things: that the rules are properly designed and that the rules are also properly administered, impartially administered, so that the efforts of the people who are participating in the competition are guided to track whatever is deemed to be socially valuable. And that gets us immediately to an Achilles heel of the whole system, namely that there are two different ways of getting ahead in economic systems, in these competitive systems. One way to get ahead is to do what the rules promise that they will reward and then get rewarded for it. The other is to try to shape the rules in one's own favor, or to shape those who administer the rules, who decide about who has won or lost the competition. This is called regulatory capture. They're revolving door phenomena. If you lived in the United States, and some of you maybe do, I wouldn't need to tell you this because we have an election going on and you can see this incredible lobbying that's going on with people, you know, throwing millions and millions of dollars at candidates trying to curry favor trying to buy themselves rules or applications of rules. And what happens there in regulatory capture is that those who make the rules or those who administer the rules themselves become objects of the competition. Now, insofar as that happens, this is bad for the effectiveness of these systems. It's bad in two different ways. First, resources that could be spent on achieving socially valuable results are in fact spent on lobbying. So Boeing is sending 100 people to Washington rather than hiring an extra 100 people to build better airplanes. And secondly, because insofar as this lobbying is successful, and it wouldn't take place if it weren't, the rules will be bent out of shape. They will no longer really track what is socially valuable. And so the whole system becomes less effective at the purposes that it is supposed to track or that we wanted to track. One other thing that happens with these sorts of systems being corrupted, if you like, through lobbying, is that you will easily get inequality spirals. And that is because those people who are more advantaged, those players in the system who are more advantaged, richer, better resourced, have greater incentives and greater opportunities to lobby the system. Greater incentives because much more is at stake for them, right? If I try to lobby the tax system and try to get a favorable tax rate, I save a few hundred dollars, maybe a few thousand dollars. But if Bill Gates does it, he saves a few $10 million or hundreds of millions of dollars. So it's much more worthwhile for richer participants to lobby and to spend the resources necessary to hire a lobbyist or two lobbyists and so on, to acquire the experience that is necessary to form coalitions, right? The rich have to form a coalition of six. I have to form a coalition of 60,000, maybe philosophy professors all descending or chipping in to hire lobbyists and so on. So what do these people who are better able to lobby do? Well, they lobby, of course, to try to get a larger share of the social product. And so that means that in the next round, they're even more able and more incentivized to lobby even harder for getting even further ahead. Now, this is particularly true with supranational rule shaping. So I think we've had a revolution in the last 20 years since the end of the Cold War, where an enormous amount of regulation that governs our day-to-day lives has been shifted upward from the national to the supranational level. And that has not happened by accident. I think a very important driving force of that has been lobbying. So very strong actors, of course, can lobby both nationally and internationally. But international rulemaking is a much softer target for lobbying. And the reason is that there, ordinary people have no chance to lobby. The supranational rules get designed and decided upon by governments or governmental negotiators. This happens behind closed doors. So in contrast to national legislation, where you know ahead of time what is being negotiated, what the proposals are, how the debate is going, with international negotiations, you don't. And even exposed, it is very difficult to figure out who argued for what, why particular language is in the document that comes out of the negotiations. So there's really no transparency, no accountability, certainly no democracy in these international negotiations. And this is the mother of all lobbying opportunities. This is where you want to lobby. You lobby through states. You go to your government and you say, can you please get me this in the international negotiations? And afterwards, it's very, very difficult, even exposed, to trace who lobbied for what and how things got in. So the shift upward is something that itself benefits the strongest parties. The strongest parties will lobby more on the supranational level and also more for the shift upward to supranational rulemaking. So I'm falling a bit behind simply because I can't see what I've got on the screen there. Good. So the most cost-effective lobbying, then, is lobbying that is focused on supranational rulemaking and on shifting rules upward from the national to the supranational level. And it is also rulemaking that is by the strong corporations, banks, industry associations, and very wealthy individuals. And of course, it has to go through governments. And here, the softest target of them all is the U.S. government. The U.S. government is the target for lobbying par excellence, because those politicians there are constantly hungry for money. They absolutely need money to survive. And the U.S. is very powerful still in these international negotiations. It has tremendous ability to set the terms. And so if you have money to spend, I mean real money to spend, then you are well advised to spend it on lobbying the U.S. government with regard to international rulemaking, supranational rulemaking. Now, if this were true, then the richest people in the U.S. should have a leg up, because they can lobby the U.S. government more effectively than anybody else can. And so just to show you that there's something to the story, you can just look at rising inequality in the U.S. These figures were unknown, even though I propagated them for many, many years, but they were unknown until the global financial crisis hit, and now it begins to be known. Even the New York Times is taking notice and so on. We had an incredible increase in inequality in the U.S. in the years, about 30 years or so, from 78 to 07. And that increase is interesting to see where that increase took place. It was not sort of the top half gaining and the bottom half losing or anything naive like that. It was really literally the top 1% capturing most of these gains, as you can see here, and the top 0.1% increasing 4.6-fold its share of national household income, and the top 0.01% increasing even 7-fold its share of national household income in these 30 years. If you've taken Economics 101, you know that there's the Kuznets curve. As a country matures, inequality goes up. Don't worry, because it will go down again. Nothing to worry about. And that is exactly what happened in the United States. It went up to the Great Depression. It went down to 1978. And then the whole thing went off the rails. The Kuznets curve no longer held. And inequality has been rising, rising, rising ever since 78, and has reached levels that are above where they were in 1928. Just to put this in perspective, the top 0.01% of the U.S. population, this is 30,000 people or 14,400 tax returns, that's where the information comes from the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service. So these 14,400 tax returns, these people have now nearly half as much income as the bottom half of all Americans, 150 million, and they have two-thirds as much income as the bottom half of the world's population, which is 3.5 billion people. So 14,400, two-thirds as much as 3.5 billion. An unbelievable inequality. This is all in exchange rate weighted measures. Now, how does that happen concretely? It happens concretely. You know, these are all phenomena that I've analyzed. I'm sure there are many more phenomena that are important. But just to mention the most important, the grandfathering of protectionist rules in the WTO agreement, the distributive effects of pollution, where we are the beneficiaries and the poor are those who are harmed by them, illicit financial flows, that's a new topic I'm working on for about a year now, that is enormous amounts of money being sucked out of poor countries into tax havens and then ultimately into rich countries. It's about $1 trillion a year, $1,000 billion a year, or 8 times all development assistance. The privileges I've talked about a lot in the past, that is a deeply entrenched rule in our global order that gives any person or group exercising effective power in a country the right to sell the resources of the country and to borrow in the country's name, even if they are entirely illegitimate, neither representing the interests of the people nor being in any way elected or authorized. They're nevertheless recognized, and so the people of the country are punished twice over. On the one hand, they lose their resources and are burdened with debts. On the other hand, they see their dictators and tyrants stabilized with all the money that those guys are paid by us for the resources and debts that they incur. So here's the global household income distribution and its development over the last 17 years. What you see here is the 1988 picture. And I flip this back and forth a little bit so that you can see it. This is, again, in exchange rate weighted terms. And you can see here that the only segment of the world's population that had a meaningful gain over this period is the top 5%. We don't have it broken down into smaller segments. Hard to do with 7 billion people. But you can see they had a 3.5% gain, not in relative but in absolute terms. They added to their already pretty large share 3.5% more of global household income. And you can see that all the other segments lost, and the greatest relative loser was the bottom quarter. If you have good eyes, you can spot it in the left bottom area of the diagram, where they lost about a third of their share of global household income. So quite a lot. Now, if you lose a third of your share of global household income, that means that you will not benefit fully from increasing average income in the world. And we find indeed that poverty has persisted at quite high rates. You see here the number of people who are chronically undernourished according to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. That number has gone up, of course, sharply in recent years, as you all know, because of the food price crisis. There has been a lot of increase in food prices, roughly a doubling between 2005 and now, with a little drop after the global financial crisis, but now the food prices are still back up again where they were in 2009. So 2008, sorry. What you see here is 788 in red. That is because that was the year of the World Food Summit in Rome, where the world's governments promised to halve the number of chronically undernourished people by 2015. The number 2015 should ring a bell. These are the That's the year of the Millennium Development Goals, which is the target year. So this was a predecessor promise, one of those superseded promises that was greatly diluted by the reformulation first in the Millennium Declaration and then further diluted in the Millennium Development Goals. So, but the original promise was to halve the number. So here again, quickly, the segments of the world's population as it stands now. Blue is the top quarter, green is the second quarter, yellow is the third quarter, and red is the fourth quarter. Now, the basic solution to this is really we have to think outside the little box of development aid, right? We can't always try harder to send doctors into the development world and try to, in some way or another, blow with our little lungs against this enormous headwind that the supranational institutional orders blowing into the faces of the poor, sort of protect them in that way. We also have to think about really supranational institutional solutions, how we can try to make that system of rules less hostile to the poor. So the idea is then try to somehow bring the interests of the majority of the human population into supranational rulemaking through structural reforms that reduce poverty and inequality, that can find international support, very important because most solutions are hopeless politically, and that are scalable and replicable so that you can start relatively small and then, if it works well, blow it up, and find reforms that bring additional reforms into view that are a plausible first step to a larger reform program. So this is the kind of thinking that went into designing the Health Impact Fund, because every three-year-old, well, make it 13, can design improvements. The world is so unjust, it's easy to say we could do this, we could do that, all good ideas, all things that would make the world more just. What we have to do is find that one good idea that satisfies all these conditions, that is better than the others, and that can be a focal point of political effort, because if we all support one of 30,000 different good ideas, none of these 30,000 ideas will be implemented. If we focus behind one, then we have a chance to actually change the game. One thing that's important here is realism, political realism. Something has to work politically. We have to make the transition possible. And so here are four ideas about what makes things more realistic, is to combine moral motivations with prudential motivations, to try to tap into prudentially motivated agents and see whether in some way you can bring them and their power to bear on the change, to support the change. Four thoughts that may be helpful. The first is that these agents are very strongly competing with each other, and so if you find ways to tap into them to sort of disadvantage them slightly, but in a way that doesn't change their competitive position, you have much better prospects than if you disadvantage particular agents in ways that weakens their competitive position. The second idea is that the existing system, which is a system where particular pieces of the supranational rule pudding are auctioned off one by one to the highest bidder, to those groups that are elite groups that are most interested in that particular piece, that system is prone to incoherence, leading to ineffectiveness, inefficiency, and instability, as the global financial crisis showed. And so it may be in the interest even of the very strongest participants to restrict their lobbying power to some extent. So they may be worse off with having all more lobbying power than they would be if they all had a little less, and if there were a little more transparency and accountability. A third thought is that the various elite agents have interests that often diverge. So it's sometimes possible to tap into the interest of one class of agents, in my case insurance companies, for example, and bring that to bear in trying to defeat another class of agents, pharmaceutical companies, for example. And fourthly, there are also principal-agent problems that are exploitable, so that CEOs notoriously have much more short-term time horizons than the companies that they lead. And so it's possible, by front-loading the benefits and back-loading the costs of a certain reform scheme, maybe to win CEO support for them, even though they're not really in the long-term interests of the companies that these CEOs are leading. So let's get to the pharmaceutical sector. I'll start with three basic principles that you would want any pharmaceutical scheme of pharmaceutical provision to satisfy, and they are quite simply, first, that with regard to the medicines that we already have, since they are cheap to produce at the margin, so the 1 millionth pill is pretty cheap to crank out, you want everybody in the world, rich or poor, anywhere, to be able to have these medicines when they need them. The important ones, not necessarily everyone, but the ones that are meaningfully related to health and survival. Secondly, you want research and development to be focused on the health problems where they can make the greatest marginal difference, where they can improve human health most cost-effectively. And thirdly, you want the whole system to be cost-effective, which means that as much as possible of the money that we spend on medicines goes right back into manufacture of additional medicines and research and development, innovation of new medicines. Now, the present system is governed by the TRIPS agreement. As you probably know, 20-year product patents are required in all WTO member states. 20 years is obvious what that means, 20 years from the time a patent is filed. That's a pretty long period, longer than it was in most countries before TRIPS came along. Product patents is maybe not so familiar. Before TRIPS, a lot of countries had process patents. India, the most important country, had those. Process patents are ones that protect a certain way of making a medicine and allow generic companies to invent around that way, to find a different way to make the same molecule. And in that way, they can circumvent the patent and then undersell the patent holder. And that's what Indian companies became very good at, and so they provided cheap medicine to Indians and the rest of the world. Product patents simply closed the door on that. It's no longer possible to do that. Implementing legislation was passed December 2004 by the Indian Parliament, and so India did exactly what it was required to do to comply by 1/1/2005. So this system does not satisfy the three principles at all that I started out with. It, first of all, does not provide universal access because the prices of medicines are very, very high during the crucial early years when they are on patent and when they have their maximum efficacy, the ones that are subject to being undermined by resistance later on and so on. And that happens as a consequence of inequality. So because economic inequality is so enormous in the world, it isn't worth it for innovators to price in a way that includes the bottom 85% of the human population. You can see this here graphically. You try to maximize profit. Profit is the markup multiplied by the sales volume. So you can see here, choose any price, go to the right to the demand curve, go down to the cost curve, and then close the rectangle that way. And it's pretty much obvious graphically that by charging $100 or $120, you have a larger rectangle than you would have if you charged $20 or $15, anything like that. Interestingly, this is also true within most of the developing countries. So even if you could perfectly price discriminate, which you can't because there's always going to be parallel imports, smuggling problems, and so on, but even if you could, it would still be the case that the optimal price to set in India or Thailand or Brazil would be a price that would exclude the large majority of the population from access. Now, focused innovation is also distorted by these same huge economic inequalities, because diseases that are concentrated among the poor, like tropical diseases, for example, there just isn't the kind of profit available to companies researching these diseases that they could make by studying hair loss, for example, or a disease that ails the rich. So that's, again, well understood, the 10-90 gap, very little attention to tropical diseases and so forth. And lastly, the present system also does very poorly in regard to cost-effectiveness. And that is so because a lot of the money that we spend on medicines, $850 billion at last count, a lot of that money, actually the large majority of that money, does not go for research and production, manufacture, but goes for litigation in particular and for advertising, trying to promote drugs, trying to create need where there isn't one, and also for various efforts of gaming, patenting costs, and so on. Now, the Health Impact Fund is supposed to be a way of undermining the existing system without changing it. So nothing gets changed. The TRIPS agreement remains the same. That's important because it can only be changed by unanimous consent, as all WTO rules. So it's a complement to the TRIPS agreement, which offers any pharmaceutical innovator voluntarily the option to register any one of their products. And if they register, they get 10 consecutive years of fixed annual rewards, which are shares of a large reward pool. The rewards are conditioned on the health impact of the medicine that it achieves globally. So you sum up the impact, the health impact of all the registered medicines each year, and then you cash out the reward pool in proportion to the proportions of health impact achieved. So if your medicine achieved 8% of the health impact of all registered medicines in a given year, you get 8% of the reward pool in that year. So that's $6 billion is what we reckon is a plausible starting point. You need a certain minimum in order to have economies of scale in health impact measurement, and also to avoid volatility of the reward rate. If there are too few drugs on the fund, then the reward rate will shake up and down too much and create too much uncertainty. Registrants can keep their intellectual property rights, but in exchange for being paid these health impact rewards, they have to promise to sell the medicine at cost. And a good way of establishing what that means is to require innovators to put the production of the medicine out for tender, get competing bids from generic companies, accept the lowest two or three bids to make sure there is capacity, and then buy the medicine from the manufacturer at the agreed upon price and sell it on at the very same price. So this way it's sure that the innovator makes absolutely no money on the manufacture and sale of the drug and makes all its money on just the health impact. Now, the cost effectiveness is a very important point because that supplements the moral point. There's an obvious strong moral case for the Health Impact Fund, but we want this to be something that's appealing also to developing country ordinary citizens, for example. And so cost effectiveness is a very important part of the argument, just like welfare legislation came into the United States and Europe when the focus was not just on the poor, but also on the middle classes, Social Security, and so on. In a similar way, I think this sort of system is attractive also to the global middle classes, in particular to the citizens of the developed countries. So, and how it boosts cost effectiveness is by reducing wasteful spending that is due to the patenting costs. You really don't need patenting in many countries anymore on the health impact fund system because you don't have to be scared of competition. You are selling at the lowest price. Litigation, again, you don't have to litigate because there's not going to be a very strong interest in other people trying to deny you or compete with you. Marketing costs, again, yes, you will do some marketing, but it will be very different. It will not be a lot of marketing that just neutralizes the marketing of other companies, but it will mostly be promotion, trying to make sure that everybody who can really benefit from the drug knows about it and also knows how optimally to take it. Counterfeiting is dropped there. That's basically something that goes on in the developing world now a lot, that people have make counterfeit drugs because it's so lucrative. If drugs are selling for $5 a capsule, you can make a lot of money by selling a lookalike at $3. Gaming, lobbying, again, there's much less room for that. And finally, there's also a great deadweight loss avoided. Deadweight losses, for those who don't know, are the losses to the world from foregone mutually beneficial trades. So if something costs $10 to produce and $100 to is the price, then all the sales between those two points, between 100 and 10, are mutually advantageous to the buyer and the seller, but cannot be consummated because the seller cannot undersell itself, because nobody would pay the $100 if other people could buy for 50 or whatever. And so these deadweight losses can, as the diagram here shows, can essentially make it possible for everybody to win in principle. So the consumer surplus is our benefit when we get a drug at a price that is lower than what we would have been prepared to pay. Now, if we lower the price from the price that you see here, this price down to this price, the consumer surplus becomes much larger. You've got this big consumer surplus, but you have to entice the innovator to register the product. So you have to pay the innovator more than what the innovator would make if the drug were on the traditional patent scheme. And what you can see here is that it's possible to do that. You can pay the innovator as much or more than this box and still have the consumers come out ahead because the deadweight loss disappears. So in very simple language, the deadweight loss disappears, is divided up between the innovators and the patients or taxpayers who fund the system in a way that makes both sides come ahead. Not each and every person, to be sure. If you have no health insurance and never get sick, you will not benefit. And if you're Bill Gates, you will not benefit either because you will pay more in taxes than you could possibly ever benefit in reduced healthcare spending. But the vast majority of people in the rich countries would also benefit from the system. So the Health Impact Fund avoids high prices, is clear from day one. Every medicine is sold at this below that ceiling, at or below the ceiling of cost. Secondly, it ends the neglect of the diseases of poverty because these diseases would be the most lucrative ones to research, the lowest hanging fruits where you can get the biggest bang for your research buck. It also alleviates last mile problems because it incentivizes innovators to try to remove all the obstacles in the developing countries in particular that stand between their medicine and its optimal impact. And so to make sure that the medicine reaches the end user in good condition, that it's affordable, you sell it even cheaper than the maximum price if you thereby get good health impact added. You try to target it so that the people who need it the most really get it, where it can have the greatest impact. You try to make sure that it's properly prescribed, and you also make sure that you promote high compliance and adherence. Financing, basically $6 billion is 0.01% of the gross national product of the world. We reckon if every country contributes 0.03%, we could actually get off with one-third of the global product. Not every country will come on board, but if we do 0.03, then the U.S. and Brazil could do it. Europe and India could do it. You know, you could pretty easily get one-third of the global product together. And then other countries could join in as they see fit. Countries could contribute perpetual bonds or very long-term bonds that would then get added to the portfolio of the Health Impact Fund. They could be invested, they could be sold, and other securities be bought for them and so on. So you could build up something like an endowment similar to what universities have in the U.S., private universities, and that would create a cushion that would assure innovators that there's really going to be money available for paying the rewards once they finish a research project successfully. Another way of doing it would be through a dedicated international tax. There's much talk now about a financial transactions tax, about a resource depletion or pollution tax, and if something like that got up, that would also be very nice to divert a fixed percentage of that into the Health Impact Fund scheme. Good, this I can skip. And last point is basically about piloting. We are now working, we want to start this year with pilots. Pilots would be one drug in one country or one province operations where the drug would be introduced at a pre-agreed very low price and the innovator would agree to that, sell it much cheaper than they sell it elsewhere, in exchange for getting health impact rewards that are based on the actual ex post observed health impact that the drug achieves. So we have various pilot sites and medicines that we are thinking about negotiating with. It's pretty difficult because you try to make a match between four parties, somebody funding the assessments, somebody funding the rewards, somebody giving a drug, and then the jurisdiction in which the pilot is supposed to be conducted. Anyway, we're working on that and we are pretty hopeful that we can get that done. The main points of a pilot are, on the one hand, to develop a metric that would allow us to assess health impact. I'm sure many of you will be interested in that question, how to do that, and a methodology for how one can populate that, how one can get the data that one needs in order to see how much health impact there has really been. And then also we want to see how innovators respond to these incentives, whether innovators roll out their drug in a different way if they get rewarded by health impact, rather than simply by selling as much product as possible, regardless to whom that gets sold. Good, so that's the end of it. Let me say one more thing in conclusion, that is that there has been a CEWG, whatever that stands for, at the WHO in recent years, examining various kinds of financing proposals, and the Health Impact Fund was one of those considered at the WHO. They said, well, you know, it's expensive and it needs more testing and so on, but so we got a lukewarm review. But they did decide that they would rank highly an R&D treaty, a globally binding R&D treaty. And they said $6 billion is the right amount and so on. So it sounds a bit like the Health Impact Fund. And so what we hope to do is over time to get people used to the idea that the R&D treaty called for in that report might very well have the content that corresponds more or less to the Health Impact Fund project. So thanks.
Thank you very much. I was wondering, though you touched upon it, what's been your experience getting the industry on board with this plan?
The industry has been a very mixed experience, and mixed not just across companies, but even within companies. So I have created a few internal fights in companies where some companies, people in the company were saying, let's invite Pogi to the next Congress that we are financing and so on. Let him spend and talk. Let's listen to this. And then others in the company said, you know, are you kidding? This guy's dangerous. We don't want this and so on. So this happened at two or three companies. Another company, the CEO changed. And so we had very good rapport with one CEO and then the next, there was nothing left. Some companies are unambiguously friendly to the proposal and really supportive. and other companies are unambiguously hostile and absolutely dead set against it. One thing that is quite remarkable is how much support we have from people within the company, especially the researchers. It's just amazing how much support. I mean, not just support sort of saying, yeah, yeah, my boy, that's a good idea, but support. I mean, I tell you one story where a researcher in Paris, we had breakfast, and he just cried, saying how sad it is that they have the stuff and they can't develop it. So he told a story. This was a small company near Paris that was bought up by Pfizer. Pfizer wanted one patent in particular from that company. They bought it up, they took the patent, and they literally destroyed all the research they were doing. So they had a very new antidiarrheal compound that was a new mode of action, really something revolutionary and interesting. And that was destroyed. All the papers were destroyed. All the lab equipment was destroyed. It wasn't even recycled or anything, just destroyed. And an amazing story. And this apparently happens a lot, that research that is promising, but promising only for developing country, kind of poor people diseases, just gets killed when you see that there's nothing in it for rich people, so let's just kill this research. So researchers are really gung-ho.
That's only not really surprising, so maybe I should ask a follow-up question. Yeah. What are the kinds of reasons why people within the industry are favorable or not favorable to the Health Impact Fund?
Yeah, so the favorable, I think the biggest reason to be favorable is that these are people who chose a career with a certain idea in mind. And the idea is, I want to do something good for humankind, maybe get famous doing it. But how many Nobel Prizes are there for curing hair loss, right? Not many. And curing malaria, finding something really good for malaria, you could get, you know, you'd be famous. I'm not saying they're all motivated by fame, but they want to do something good and important, right? They're much more attracted to doing an important developing country disease than to doing something which is much, much harder at this point, let's say a little progress against cancer or something like that. So there are a lot of really big things waiting to be harvested, but they're not being harvested. The people who are against it, again, there's one main reason, and it's very, very obvious what that is. It is that the Health Impact Fund is a kind of Pandora's box, right? It appears in public and says, look, you don't have to play. This is voluntary. You can register, not register, as you see fit. But what if your competitor registers in the same therapeutic class? You get screwed. Right, so I'm the guy who invents the ninth statin, and I have two ways of getting ahead. One is I spend hundreds of millions advertising my statin and say, look, I've got a Me Too drug too. And I, with a lot of effort, I get 10% of the market share if I'm really, really lucky. But a much more elegant way is to say I put it on the Health Impact Fund, and first of all, I sell it to the 85% who don't get it up till now. And secondly, of course, very quickly, I'll be underselling these other guys so badly that every insurance company and every national health system is going to say, well, if this statin is just as good as the others, then you better take that other statin. So that's what they're afraid of. They're saying, you know, in the moment, we are making much, much more money per unit of health impact than what the Health Impact Fund would pay. And once these more efficient drugs that do more work for the money that they earn are around and start competing with us in the same therapeutic class, then it's going to be. And here comes in the, you may remember, the last prudential point, the principal agent problem, right? So this is something which for companies is a very bad proposition. So if a company looks 100 years ahead, it says, no, 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 we don't want to go down that road. But a CEO who has 5 or 6 years left to go is going to say, look, for the first 10 or 20 years, the Health Impact Fund is going to be populated with poor people diseases, because these are the lowest hanging fruits. That's where the biggest money is going to be made. And then maybe later there will be global diseases medications registered, but that's going to be under the next CEO or two or three CEOs down the road. So what we hope is that by having front-loaded the benefits and back-loaded the costs, so to speak, for the companies, we can win the hearts and minds of some CEOs and some present shareholders.
Well, I'll exercise my prerogative to ask a question then.
It's not much of a prerogative if nobody's competing.
You started out by pointing out the perils of regulatory capture, and you're making a proposal that is great. How will you prevent some method of regulatory capture to outlaw the health impact fund down the road, where the CEOs of some of the drug companies that are antagonistic to this in the U.S. will figure out some way to convince U.S. legislators to come up with some ad hoc reason to say what you're doing is anti-competitive or some trumped-up reason and shut it down before it even gets started?
Yeah, it's an international thing, right? It's not so easy to shut down. So first of all, if a company makes that sort of if you make that sort of a claim, you say, well, you know, this is anti-competitive because somebody else sells something much cheaper. The answer to that truly is, well, I'm sorry, but this is capitalism. This is a free market, right? And if somebody else wants to sell it cheaper and if governments want to get together and pay them for that in some other way, that is their prerogative, right? It's a free market. And so you're entitled to your monopoly on your compound, but you're not entitled at all that all the competitors in the same space also charge very high prices. So I think this would be very hard. Of course, there could be a lot of lobbying that would prevent the United States from joining. That is very foreseeable that that could happen. But again, like the International Criminal Court, this thing can get going, and then hopefully the U.S. in 100 years or whatever will see the light and join. And that could happen with the Health Impact Fund. If the U.S. doesn't join, what happens is that we don't get the money into the pot from the United States, which is okay, but the U.S. citizens will still get the full benefit. So the medicine will be cheap in the U.S., and however, we will not measure the health impact in the U.S. That's the one little sanction. What that means is that the incentive to market the medicine with tender, loving care for optimal health impact gains, health gains, that incentive will not exist in the U.S. In the U.S., the medicine will be for sale, but nobody will spend a lot of effort trying to sell it. It will just be there, and people can buy it, which is good, but the health impact will be measured only in the countries that also contribute, and in those countries, companies will then have an incentive to try hard to make sure that the medicine has its optimal effect. Larry and Stereo.
Arrived already on. Thanks, Thomas. I have versions of Samia's question for you, which she put, of course, more politely than I did, or am about to. So it's a first question and two other small comments. So you start by saying we're going to need, you want to be realistic. And you realize that in order to be realistic, you're going to have to bring the people on board who actually have all the power and the money. And that's the international elites. You say you need the international elite supporters. It's not going to happen. So I commend you for that. That sounds right. But then you started by showing us the diagrams of how the international elites fare under the current system and how they have over the last 30 years and how there's seemingly no end in sight. And, I mean, it would seem like the international elites would have to be stupid if the assumption here is we're going to bring them on board as self-centered people to shift over to a policy like this. And your explanation is why you're hoping it might work is that you're going to front-load the benefits so you're not being stupid if you think you're going to retire in 5 years. But there are boards at these companies, and there are people overseeing these companies, and there are people who take relatively long-term views of these companies, and they're seeing the screen that says, of course this will be terrible for them down the road, but it'll be good for the next 5 years. And it just seems as if a few companies might be tempted to take this step and say, well, let's give it a shot. Maybe for 5 years we'll be profitable. It seems like the vast majority are going to say, like most people do, hey, things are going really well now. I mean, really, really well. We're not just like eking out a living. I mean, look at these diagrams that Thomas puts up at the beginning. I mean, we are just raking it in, hands over fist, compared to the rest of the world. I want to jeopardize that on the off chance that for the next 5 years we might do slightly better, it just seems really hard to believe that that's going to happen. Though I wish it would. I mean, I'm just, you know, when I listen to your diagrams, it seems all the incentives are going to really heavily line up in the opposite direction. And then you say things like, well, we're not going to have to worry. This is going to take care of problems of litigation. It's going to remove the last mile problem, et cetera. These are just little side-ins. It's not clear to me how that's going to work because, you know, one person is going to register their 9th statin, and then someone else is going to register the 10th statin. That's a variation of theirs. And then these things are going to be distributed, and there's going to be counterfeiting going on, even though you say there's not much counterfeiting, but there'll be counterfeiting going on from one to another, and then these people will claim this amount of qualities was accomplished, and it's due to ours. And the other people are going to say, no, it was due to ours. We are the ones who supplied those pills. And the kind of bureaucratic mess that it would take to really know whose pills came from which plant, et cetera, there's going to be, I mean, I would predict, armchair philosopher that I am, there'll be all sorts of litigation about who actually supplied the statin that reduced the blah, 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 blah. And the last mile problem, it's hard to see how the approach you have could solve the last mile problem as opposed to give you every incentive not to reach the last mile. Because since the whole incentive here is to get as much bang for the buck, you're going to want to get the first low-hanging people that you can easily get to. You're not going to build all the roads for the infrastructure and everything else so you can reach a few more people, get some qualities. You'll take that money, I would think, invested somewhere else on another higher low-hanging fruit, at least if you have that capability. And then all those people out in the hinterlands will still be unserved, I would have thought. So those are just three
a few
reactions.
Problems. Good. So let me start with the last mile problem. So the last mile problem, you are right that it will not be worth it for companies to go to a village that is very remote, where you have to build a road to get there and where only one patient lives, for sure. And that's fine with me. But much of the last mile problem is lots and lots of poor people living in close proximity to each other, pretty easy to reach, but no incentive to reach them. For example, there's no electricity there, or it's expensive with diesel generators and no refrigerators. And so it's very difficult to stock the medicine there and keep it fresh and so on. And that sort of last mile problem is one that companies would love to solve because you get a huge amount of health impact at very low cost, and they're not doing it now. Because you can't mark up the product. So now let me see whether I can say something about the other sort of larger problems about the resistance there. So the first thing is the pharmaceutical companies are not really earning hand over fist. They did in the 90s, but now the earnings are much lower. And there are several reasons for that. One is that there is a bit of a pipeline problem. There's not as much real genuine innovation going on, partly because the big gains have been harvested, and there are not many additional ones, sort of harder and harder to move the frontier, and the changes, the increments are smaller and smaller. So secondly, the profits don't all flow to the pharmaceutical companies, right? The companies are, in theory, making a lot of money in terms of the markup multiplied by the sales volume. But if a great deal of that money goes into litigation and advertising and so on, marketing, then the net profit for the companies isn't all that great. So the gain for the poor is not the same as the loss to the pharmaceutical companies. I think that's an important thing to see. That lawyers will also be losing a lot, so they may lobby against this in some way, but it's difficult to say. There should be more litigation. But anyway, so don't think that just because the poor gain, there must be corresponding losses by the elites. And the other important point is that the pharmaceutical companies are only one segment of the elites. So you have to look at various different segments, various different political forces that influence the policy stance of the rich countries. Pharmaceutical companies will lobby, and I think if they lobby, those who will lobby against, so I agree with that. But there are, for example, insurance companies. Insurance companies' interests may be quite different. The interests of ordinary citizens may be quite different. They will say, look, we are paying in the U.S., we are paying 1/6 of our gross national product for healthcare, and we are 38th in the world. This is not a good score. And so maybe we should think about how to make the system more efficient. Politicians, right, they also have other things they would like to spend their money on. And they are happy for opportunities to save money, to maintain the existing efficiency of the system, but at much lower cost. So I think it's true that the pharmaceutical companies will not really befriend this proposal. I think that's right. But that doesn't mean that it can't happen.
Very quick follow-up, especially since there wasn't a long queue, at least when I started. My thought wasn't really so much a thought about the pharmaceutical companies per se. Mm-hmm. It was more about your starting off with a notion of who's really calling the shots in the world about global policies. And you say there's this global elite and certain very, very powerful companies and certain very, very powerful and rich individuals. And that combination has every incentive to lobby in certain ways. And they've been just making money hand over fist. Forget about with the pharmaceuticals per se, but yeah. You know, the really powerful people who have the ability to shape WTO's policies, they're going to look at the world and they're going to say, life is good. It's good to be the king. And any policy that comes along that says, in essence, you know, it's good to be the king, but there's a whole hell of a lot of paupers out there. And what about them, too? You're going to have to persuade them that by changing in this direction, and you said a little about this, they don't care so much about the absolute, they care about relative, they just don't want to be the king. But I suspect a lot of them are going to want to be the king with everything that comes with being the king. And if they see this as being a threat to that, whether it's in 5 years or 50 years, I think those very, very powerful interests that you started out describing at the beginning are going to line up against it. I mean, I wish it weren't so. It's just that's the fear.
So it's possible. I mean, this can very easily fail, right? And we haven't much to show. Our generation hasn't much to show in the last 30 years or so in terms of protecting the poor, right? The poor, as you saw, have lost a lot of ground and so on. So if I were a betting person, I would bet my money on your diagnosis and say, well, this next 30 years are going to look the same. But I'm looking at it in a different way. I'm saying, is there any way that we can make a difference other than by donating to effective NGOs and by going into the developing world and volunteering our services as doctors or whatever, the Paul Farmer sort of route? Is there anything that we can do to stop the harms or reduce the harms that emanate from this rule system? And I think these rules are to some extent fungible. Had we had a bunch of people really understanding what was going on during the TRIPS negotiations, I think we could have made a difference there. We couldn't have stopped TRIPS, but we could have maybe changed TRIPS at the margins, and even marginal changes there in the rules are worth 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 doctors going into the developing world and volunteering their services, right? I mean, these rules have enormous distributive effects. So that's the idea. And also, even if the Health Impact Fund doesn't get through, I think it does change the idea. It being on the table, it being debated, changes a little bit the mindset of people and saying, you know, why not? Why not sort of rely more or find ways in which we can incentivize better performance for poor people and so on? So even that at the margins can change a little bit the outcome of the negotiations, what comes out of CEWG or whatever it is.
So we do have a queue now. I have Daniel, Gopal, and Jurgen.
So in a way, you've started answering the question just with the last few sentences of your response to Larry, which is, it's got a sort of philosophical question, if you don't, but a philosophical question of the kind that I think, you know, that flows directly from the description that you gave. So we have choices to make as theorists about the level of utopianness that we will engage in describing systems that could exist. So, you know, take some kind of communist utopia as being the far end, right, and take a sort of quietism which would move the goalposts ahead by, you know, an infinitesimal amount, which would still be cashed out by, you know, some lives being saved that otherwise wouldn't have, but that doesn't even try to make any structural change whatsoever. The system stays exactly as it is, and we just try to, you know, make people pay $5 more a month to whatever, Oxfam or something. We don't. So you have that spectrum. So the first question I have for you is, where do you see your proposal lying, I mean, in a vague sense, on that spectrum? So, you know, the way you present it, it sounds like, wow, you know, this isn't utopian at all. This is actually trying to fasten onto incentives that are already there. We're not expecting people to get, you know, all of a sudden much better than they are. As a matter of fact, it may take away some things that people who are selfish right now don't like about the present system, and it gets them into these collective action problems, and they'll all be thanking Thomas Poga for having made their lives so much easier than it otherwise would be. But then we hear, you know, Larry, and we think, oh, no, hold on a second. He's been, you know, Thomas has been sort of presenting it in a way which really sheds the spotlight on the non-existent, the actually existing incentive structures that could be, instrumentalized for this. But he's sort of soft-soaping some very real obstacles that Larry laid out. So I guess where do you see it as lying on that spectrum? It's a very vague question, but I'm kind of curious about the way you see it now, as you've developed it for years, and you've actually pushed at institutions in order to try to get it to get some traction. And I guess the question that I was going to ask, but which you actually started answering, is: do you see this as, you know, is the way that the theoretical landscape should look, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom? In other words, we should even let the Peter Singers of the world, you know, sort of, you know, who are sort of more institutionally naive, perhaps. I'm thinking of that exchange that he had with Cooper, you know, describe a situation in which and then we should have people working at the sort of closer end, you know, just looking at ways in which to put Band-Aids, you know, because Band-Aids do, after all, you know, work to some degree. So how do you see the total sort of theoretical landscape, anyway, it's a very vague question, but I'm curious to get your sort of meta reflections on this, as you've been engaged in this for a number of years now.
Good, I'll try. So in one sense, I'm in different points on the spectrum, because I want to say that this is a first step, a pretty realistic first step of a larger reform program. And so I'm trying to think several steps ahead. You know, what would you do if the Health Impact Fund got up? What opportunities would it open, and so on? And as you go further down that road, it becomes progressively more utopian. I would say now that the chances of getting the Health Impact Fund or something very close to it up and running is about 20% over the next 10, 15 years or so. So I think it is actually doable, and I could do it with two countries. Those are the ones I put most of my effort into, India and Germany. So if Germany promotes it, you know, the SPD wins the next election, the SPD is already officially committed to it. If they push it within the EU, they have to adopt it as part of their coalition contract with either the Greens or the Christian Democrats, whoever they form a coalition with. If they then push it within the EU, so not everybody in the EU will adopt it, but certainly the Nordics, the Netherlands, maybe France and so on will. So that will be one hotbed of support. And then India is, I think, the most politically powerful country within the developing world that will have a lot of followers. So India will bring on maybe Brazil, South Africa, and so on, major countries in the developing world. And so the collaboration between the Germans and the Indians could get this thing up and running. So I think it is entirely doable. Obviously, it will not be adopted in exactly the form in which I presented it here. They will negotiate, and they will find their own little ways to do it this way or that way or the other way. But once established, I think it would be a very, very powerful model of intelligent institutional reform that designs in the interests of the poor. And that's really what I hope to achieve here. Now, you had one other point that you wanted, right? Or not?
It was pretty good.
Leave it.
Hi, Thomas. So I have two unrelated but both very short questions. So one is, I think you were anticipating, and I was too, which is why I didn't put my hand up earlier, that some empirical person would want to ask you about your measurement scheme. But I'm actually quite interested in it, so even though I'm not an empirical person. Can you say something about how you imagine doing the measuring of the health impact? That's one question. The other one, which is different and maybe has a short answer. So sometimes you talk about one kind of strategic method for trying to counteract pushback and the influence of the pharmaceutical companies as trying to, as it were, recruit the insurance companies to counteract them and fight against them. But as I understood the proposal, the first kind of early segment of the whole action is going to be in the developing world with the low-hanging, high burden of disease fruit. But if that's right, it looks like the insurance companies don't have a stake either way. So how does that fit with the idea of bringing the insurance companies on board? Those are the two questions.
Yeah, the insurance companies would be a counterweight against pharmaceutical companies lobbying that rich countries should not join. Right? We want rich countries and poor countries to join the Health Impact Fund proposal. And it's true that initially the low-hanging fruits and the developing world, but pharmaceutical companies in the rich countries might lobby against the Health Impact Fund saying we will support it only if there's ring fencing, only if the whole Health Impact Fund from the beginning is legally designed in such a way that it cannot include drugs in a therapeutic class in which patented medicines exist.
It's a short follow-up. But the insurance companies only have an interest to fight against that if they're either, I mean, one different way to put it, if they're looking fairly far ahead
right.
to when it might become relevant
right.
to rich countries and therefore to their enrollees.
Exactly. So it's exactly the mirror image of one another, right? The pharmaceutical companies, insofar as they look ahead and say, no, we don't want to go there. The insurance companies, also looking ahead, will say, well, actually, we do want to go there.
So I guess the last short version of that question is, but why do you think the insurance companies will look ahead instead of just saying, we're not going to do anything right now, let's wait and see?
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe they won't. I mean, it's, again, this is just something that I can try to mobilize. I can try to, and I've worked a bit with insurance companies, not a lot, but I've worked with large investors, for example, very big pension funds and so on, try to get their support. So it's hard to say whether this can work, but at least that's an idea, right? Because what came out in Larry's question is the standard view, namely that the elite is a kind of monolithic black box, and they have an interest in being rich and being richer. And that's in one sense true, but the elite, you know, there's a lot of different interests hiding there. People make money in very many different ways, often at the expense of each other. And we can try to look into that black box, and maybe that is helpful in various ways. Now, before I get to the measurement, I wanted to say one more thing about the 30,000 flowers blooming. Now, is Daniel still there? Or is he just gone?
Well,
but
wait.
Daniel! Okay, the 30,000 flowers. So I think a very, very important part of this political equation is morally motivated people, progressive people like yourselves, right? We are not strong enough to change the world just like that, but we are strong enough, I think, to put ideas out there and to unite behind these ideas. And one thing that has held us back the last 30 years, I think, is precisely the 30,000 flowers, right? We are very, very in love with diversity, eccentricity, right? In philosophy, if you have a view that is ever so similar to somebody else's view, nobody wants to hear it, right? You want some completely spectacularly different view. And so it is with all these reforms. We have to learn to work together like the different industries are learning to work together to support IP, for example, intellectual property and so forth. And if we can achieve that, if we can speak more or less with one voice, this is also the idea behind ASAP, by the way, Academics Stand Against Poverty. If we can speak with one voice, we can mobilize these relatively weak forces, but try with them and with intelligence to master much stronger forces, to bend them in our direction, guide them, and so on, and maybe change them something. So that's another thing. We should not want 1,000 flowers to bloom. We should look at these flowers and then decide which one we want to throw our weight behind and really push that hard, focus. And if I had the support of half the people in the space, you know, the Health Impact Fund would be irresistible. Should I say something about measurement or not? Gopal. So the metric is one that you know well, sort of Quali Dali kind of metric. Is everybody familiar with that? Yes, right? That, I don't need to talk about that. And then in doing the actual measuring, a huge amount of bang for the buck has to come out of statistical sampling methods. So you can't follow each pill to each end user. And there are two ways of doing the statistical sampling. One would be by packaging. So each thousandth, I can't say that word, of packages gets embedded a microchip or something so you can follow it to the end user and see what that person, what experience with the drug the person made, what other treatment, if any, the person would likely have gotten if there hadn't been this cheap drug available to them, and so on. Or you can do it with the cluster method with more prevalent diseases where you divide, you throw a fly screen over the map basically and divide the world into neighborhoods of 5,000 people each, and then you research in depth one out of 1,000 neighborhoods. You don't have to do every country every year, but you can do, you know, again with statistical sampling, you can send your teams around and do in-depth sampling in various countries every 2 or 3 years, and then interpolate in between, you know, how things have developed in the neighboring countries, or interpolate from 1 year to the next survey year and so on. So you can save a lot of money in that way. We reckon still that we will spend up to 10% of the total reward fund, you know, the total $6 billion on measurement, but we want to raise that through fees on the registrants, so they get the full amount, the full $6 billion, but they have to pay a fee. The reason is that that will deter registrations by of medicines that the innovator isn't so confident in. We want the strongest, the ones that they really believe will have a lot of impact, to register.
We have 4 minutes. We have one more question from Jürgen.
Oh, two very small ones. The first one is a very...
The first one is very, sorry, a very practical one. Why 6 billion? I mean, you seem to be very, very fixed. Is that an emission load? Do you see that growing? The second one is, I mean, there's, you know, you talk a lot in some sense about the political economy, and a lot of agents have been put forward. But there's, you know, there hasn't been any talk about some of these big existing funds that are already playing in this area, and you're competing against these. To some extent, it seems, and they are really, really, I mean, it's my understanding that they are very, very powerful and having a huge impact. So I'd like to hear a bit more about that.
Yeah, so these other funds, I mean, these are the best of our friends, right? I mean, the Global Fund, for example, is a fund that we are like this, you know. The Health Impact Fund might actually be part of the Global Fund. We would not duplicate the administrative. They have 600 people sitting in Geneva already. They're dealing with large amounts of money. They've had some very sad experiences lately, as you probably read, you know, about accusations of this and that. They are supervised by the World Bank. They have some... So we don't want to duplicate all of that. The Global Fund, Christoph Ben is their main person who's been there from the very beginning and a very close friend of mine. And so we definitely, definitely would work with them. The Global Fund is confined to three diseases, AIDS, TB, and malaria, and is looking for ways to broaden its mandate because, of course, morally speaking, other diseases are just as important and should also come within the purview of possible projects and so on. And the Global Fund spends a good bit of money on medicines that are patented because, for example, with AIDS, right, you find that a number of your patients are no longer responsive to the standard treatment that is now off-patent, the cheap stuff, and they need, you know, second-line therapy. And second-line therapy is very, very expensive. So the Health Impact Fund comes into the picture and incentivizes the development of new medicines and makes those available very cheaply. So these big organizations, also UNICEF and so on, they would all benefit in various ways from that scheme. This scheme is a complement to these funds or a way of expanding them. So one other thing to be said there is that there's now a movement, people like Gorik Ohms and Larry Gostin and so on, to establish some sort of a floor of a decent minimum of health expenditure, something like $60 per person everywhere, and where countries are not able reasonably to finance it, it should come out of international aid of one sort or another. And the Health Impact Fund project would be part of that, that you say, this is one plank of this, but then there are other planks that would support, let's say, doctors and nurses, try to stem the brain drain and so on. The various other ways, other components of such a strategy that would cost in total $60 per person per year. So we very much want to collaborate and are collaborating with them. There's nothing else that really has the same innovation incentive component that the Health Impact Fund has. Now, the other thing, what was the other thing?
$6 billion.
Yeah. Basically, again, the $6 billion is a minimum, right? First of all, having a pool is pretty ingenious. The reason is that by having a pool, you allow the reward rate to be determined by demand and supply of innovation. So you can say to the taxpayers, look, there will never be a windfall for the pharmaceutical industries, because as soon as such a windfall appears, as soon as the reward rate becomes unreasonably high, it will be competed away by additional registrations. And conversely, you can say to the pharma companies, don't worry about registering and the reward rate falling down to zilch or something. It won't happen, because when the reward rate becomes unreasonably low, then all innovators having a choice will stay away from the health impact fund and the reward rate will recover. So that's a very nice self-adjusting system. You may know there's a huge debate going on about how much does it really cost to develop a new medicine, with well-paid economists giving figures in the $4 billion range and so on. We don't know, and we don't need to know, because the fund will show how many registrations we get. I think about 2025, but who knows? We'll see. So $6 billion is the two main reasons. One is that the assessment work that we will do in many different countries is subject to economies of scale. So on a per-drug basis, it's much cheaper to assess 24 drugs in Indonesia than to assess two or three drugs in Indonesia. So, and that means that the cost per drug has sort of a shape like this. And we want to exploit the steep part of the curve. We want to go beyond five or six drugs to 24, something like that. And the second thing is the volatility of the reward rate. So if you had only five or six drugs on the fund, then any new registration coming in, especially of a very important drug, might jerk that rate around. So the rate would be like the tail of a dog. It would sort of go up and down. And this is something that would scare innovators away. They would say this makes it much too unpredictable. Whereas with this somewhat larger fund, $6 billion, you will, after a few years, initially you will not know what the rate is going to be, but over the years you will find out, and the rate will equilibrate around some sort of level, and if you ask me, it will over time increase, simply because the lowest hanging fruit have been harvested and it's getting harder and harder to achieve additional health impact. So the rate will gently increase, of course with little ups and downs, but these ups and downs won't be dramatic, and we don't want them to be dramatic. Last point, this is a minimum, so you can double it very easily. If you double it, the reward rate doubles. That's the immediate effect. But that, of course, then lures additional registrations to come on. And so in the end, the reward rate will only increase by, let's say, 20%, and you get more. And so governments can freely decide. They say, this system works really, really well. Let's put another billion in. Or new countries can come on board, and that could also increase the $6 billion amount. So more would never be a problem, but less, I think, we get into difficult terrain.
Last question.
Last question is
redundant.
Okay. I speak French. Je parle français.
My question is redundant.
Oh, redundant. Okay. Ah. So you're waving.
It's useless. Thank you.
Okay.
So thank you very much.
Pas de quoi.
This is our last speech.